My goal is to help you or to elicit questions from you. So I would like to have a relatively long Q&A at the end of this. My name is Michalis Mesa. I'm the Chief Connectivity Officer of LTC. I have been working on most of the connectivity issues, and by that we mean anything that has to do with bits moving in and out of the laptop to the internet between laptops. Since day one of the official inauguration of this project, I'm very happy to see this meeting growing and growing and growing. I have this is probably my fifth such meeting now. I was counting the presentations on my laptop before I started, and I would like in a matter of 2 hours try to give you an overview of what we have done in the past, what we are doing right now, and where we are going to be going in the future, as well as discuss some real-world implementation guidelines for deployments based on the experiences that we already had with the laptops out there. And also give you some glimpse of things that we have started in other places regarding connectivity with the laptop. Given that I haven't seen most of you before in these meetings, I have to start from scratch and give you an overview of some of our principles and why, in the hope of letting you understand why we are doing things the way we are doing things. Because we are doing things quite differently from most other people out there. And the main principle that influences us is the principle of constructionism, the fact that we are learning by interaction and by doing things. So in a typical instructionist model, if you have a laptop, all that you hear is for that laptop to communicate with a central server that basically gives material in a very controlled way, in a very controlled time schedule. And we have seen that in many educational technology projects deployed around the world. We don't discount the value of that model, but we would like to take it further and enable our model too with our technology. So it is important to us to have one-to-many, but it's also important to us to have one-to-one communication between laptops in a complete peer-to-peer fashion, so that the laptop aids and enhances the natural patterns of communication between kids. So a very brief way to put that is that to us, child-to-child communication when we designed this laptop was as important or even more important than child-to-internet, which is what most people optimize for. That creates a set of unique challenges, because now you don't have a single model in mind. You have two models to work with. In standard computers and standard hotspots and access points out there, you will see that most people totally discount the peer-to-peer communication model. If you go to most commercial hotspots out there, Wi-Fi access points, have two laptops associated with the same hotspot, try to communicate between the laptops, can't do it. It is a feature, by the way. People are selling that as a feature. In our case, we didn't really, that wasn't enough. We understand the context in which people might think that this is useful, but it's definitely not the educational context that we have. So in order to implement the approach I just designed, I just described, we added to a standard laptop device two components. The first is a mesh networking stack. A mesh networking stack is an extension to standard wireless networks that allows laptops to form a multi-hop network, in other words, forward traffic and information for each other in a way that's completely transparent to their users, so that you can have a large geographically dispersed network. By that I mean, a network that spans a whole building, or a network that spans, a small neighborhood in a village, without having to have any infrastructure installed. We wanted to enable communication between kids without the need of specialized infrastructure. We understand that these laptops are going to be deployed in mostly disadvantaged areas, and we can define those in a variety of ways, whether that's, a village in Nigeria or a low-income housing project in Brazil. It's still the same situation. You can expect that there is going to be infrastructure in that place. And if there is not going to be infrastructure with traditional laptops, there is no communication. If there is no communication for a communication device like the laptop, then by definition, you are not making good use of the technology, and you are not making very good use of your investment in that. So that's our first component, and it has to do with our very low level connectivity. It has to do with the piping between the laptops, if you want, the virtual pipes that exist between the laptops, and it has to do with forming networks that are geographically larger than what a single traditional access point Wi-Fi network would allow, without the need for those. The second component, if you want, the second addition to a standard laptop software stack, and the most complex, is the collaboration software. We have, in the laptops that you have in your hands right now, most of the applications that run on the laptops can share the kids' work in between laptops in various ways and capacities depending on the application. And they can do that without much, again, of an external support. We have been accustomed to a model that every time that we have to communicate or do something in a collaborative way with computers, there has to be a big server farm somewhere that facilitates that. That is all fine when what we have in mind is the application of computing in the developing world between, for example, employees of a large corporation. However, the cost implications and the control, if you want, implications don't really apply to kids in the developing world or kids in general, I would say. You can't really expect that every time that we need to talk with each other, some server has to be in the middle. And unfortunately, modern day operating systems sort of force us to do that. If we want to exchange a file between us these days without laptops, we all carry expensive laptops. We want to exchange a file. It's 2008, and we haven't changed our ways since I first started using computers. We still have to get a floppy. Well, it's not a floppy now, it's a USB key. And we have to do it in the same way we did it 25, 30 years ago. No progress whatsoever. in that respect. Lots of reasons for doing that, security, complexity, but that's not acceptable. That's not a very good use of technology and the capabilities that technology has. We believe so much, so deeply into this principle that we build collaboration as an integral part of the laptop's user interface. And you can see that, and that's the reason that the laptop looks quite different from traditional desktop environments. Traditional desktop environments are based on the idea of files and programs. Sugar is based on the idea of activities, where what we do on the data and how we communicate the results of our work is all integrated under the same user interface. We also have to have a lot of information about who's around us, not only about what we are doing. In order to communicate, you have to know with whom to communicate, what they are doing. So that the closest analog that we can find in existing systems is probably instant messaging systems that have presence, that can tell you what the person on the other side is doing. However, here we have a lot richer primitives that extend all the way to the applications that the kids are going to be using. Back to the mess. When we started the design of the laptop back in 2005, the main requirement that drove most of the decisions that we took with the laptop, with the current laptop that you have in your hand, was power consumption. We thought that power was extremely important. Out of the 1.2 billion kids, school-age children in the world, about half of them don't have reliable electricity at home. So designing a device that requires to be plugged in most of the time wasn't really an option. And we sort of derived a lot of the decisions that we made down the way in the design process from that fundamental decision. This is a sharp break from what the computer industry has been doing recently. The computer industry is moving towards laptops purely for financial reasons. They can make more money selling laptops than desktops. However, you see that the laptops are becoming more and more power hungry. The standard power supply 2 or 3 years ago used to be 70 watts. The standard laptop power supply these days is 100 watts. Our power supply is 10. So we are moving, we're diverging from what people were doing. And in the mesh network design, that had quite a few implications that I would get into in the next slide. We wanted the mesh network not to be radically different. Existing mesh network software stacks were quite different from a programming perspective than a traditional network transport like an Ethernet interface or a standard Wi-Fi wireless network interface. We didn't want to deviate too much from that because that would make application development more difficult. So we wanted something that looked as close to a network, standard network interface as possible. We obviously wanted to follow some kind of standard. We didn't want to reinvent the wheel in that respect. And when we started that work, the IEEE 82.11s standardization committee was starting to produce their early drafts, and we saw a lot of things that were very close to what we wanted to do, so we followed closely the development of that standard, which is, has not yet been ratified, but what we have is very close. It's a proper subset of what's in the standard. And of course, we wanted that network to be as large as possible. A mesh network, any network, has to be, its value increases with a degree of connectedness between nodes. So we really wanted to be able, for example, if you take those two examples, we really wanted to have this scenario as opposed to that scenario. So you see that this node is turned off, its antennas are down, so nobody can get to the internet. As soon as this node comes up, then we can connect to the rest of the network, and these guys can get all the way out to the internet. That's the basic idea. That's the reason that the laptop has ears. Unlike traditional laptops, we don't only have to optimize for the scenario where the laptops have to operate in a classroom where a traditional access point will be used, and where all the energy from the access point to the laptop, most of the energy, to be precise, comes through scattering. So having good antennas and nicely oriented antennas doesn't make much of a difference. In the case of a mesh network, we wanted to really maximize the links and the distance between individual laptops as much as possible. So every little gain that you can get there counts. We don't operate in that scenario under the link margin conditions of a standard access point deployment. So for example, right now in this room, yesterday we probably had something in the order of 100 laptops. We have two access points, one back there and one in the front, if I remember correctly. Every laptop in this room is about a maximum of 20 meters away from the access point that they have to communicate with, and they get a link that's very, very good and very strong, very robust. In this scenario, we'd like to enable communication between laptops that were several hundred meters away, if possible. And the links are quite marginal, so everything that we can squeeze out counts. A lot of people are asking us, what's the range between laptops? And the technical answer, the honest technical answer is, it really depends. I can't tell you how much it is, because it really depends on the environment, it really depends on how much activity is out there, radioactivity. So I can't really give you an honest answer that I can, you can hold me to. I can give you, in an environment like this, that's going to be, you know, 100 meters. I can guarantee you that it will work 100 meters, but I know what the environment is a priori. I can also tell you that in the Australian outback, where one of our testers lives, we are able to communicate between two laptops for at a distance of over 1 kilometer. And it wasn't passing a few bits back and forth. The guy was doing audio streaming between the laptops and was counting the distance as his criterion for the distance was that the audio stream was not being interrupted. Can you repeat that experiment? Not unless you get in a very quiet, from a radio perspective, area. Not in a city. I can't see that scenario working very well in a city. So now you know why those funny bunny ears in the laptop are there. They give you a significant advantage over standard laptop architecture. Even when you are using an access point, we are able to connect with the laptop. I've seen many scenarios where my standard laptop was very marginal and my XO was connecting very well. And I have repeated that, I have seen that repeatedly. So we know that we did something good there. How do we solve the power issue was a little bit more complicated. And the reason is that when you run a protocol stack, a networking protocol stack on your laptop, you have to run it on some kind of CPU. I mean, you have to run it on the main CPU. If you run the main CPU, the CPU is usually, these days, the CPU is the most power-hungry component of the laptop. So, if you wanted to have, in the previous scenario, for example, if you wanted to have this guy here, who is very crucial, because this is the guy that everybody else depends to get to the destination here, to stay on, so that everybody else can communicate, that guy has to stay on. Okay? That guy has to run its CPU. That means 3 to 4 watts in our laptop, means more than 15 in any other laptop out there, at a minimum. So, because of the way the 82.11s networking standard is organized, we're able to add a radio. Instead of using a simple radio, we used a Wi-Fi radio that has a small CPU and its own memory. So we run the mesh network stack completely on that CPU. So when our power management advances, what we will be able to do is suspend the CPU and still have the auxiliary CPU on the radio forward frames for other laptops without penalizing the kid that is doing that by making him or her be always plugged in or use the crank or having, you know, the thing on the sun so that the solar is on. That was the idea. The implementation is quite complex. We are most of the way there at this point in time. And we feel very confident that we will be able to deliver that in the near future. But that was the main driver, this power conservation architecture was the main driver that determine a lot of the other decisions that we did.
Before you go to the next slide,
yes.
Would it be possible just to, I am a lay person when it comes to these things, so, and I will be explaining this hopefully to people who are in my same situation. So would it be possible just to maybe take at least me through, I'm not sure if anyone else here can benefit from that, but just what you mean in just as simple terms as possible.
I understand 100% the question, and I thought that I tuned it.
I tuned
my presentation somewhere in the middle of the road between technical and completely late, but another way to express that is that these laptops can forward traffic for each other without consuming a lot of energy. Or the way to put it is by consuming very, very little energy compared to traditional laptops. So you can create those. If you were using traditional laptops and you wanted to create this kind of topology, of network topology, where everybody, like the last guy, connects to the internet through a path through this cloud. In normal laptop architectures, each and every one of these nodes has to consume a minimum of 12 watts. I'll give you the number that was the minimum when we started doing this. With our architecture, every laptop can do the same thing by consuming 0.8 watts. That's the main difference. So we have more than an order of magnitude improvement there. And what was the state of the art 3 years ago, I think that the numbers today are better for us, but I don't have them, so I'm not going to quote you, because I don't think you can find even $500 laptops or $600 laptops have dual core processors these days that consume 20 and 30 watts as opposed to 12. So that's in an environment where there is no electricity, or electricity is not as abundant as it is here, encourages the users of the laptops to let the laptops do that without them having to worry that their battery is going to run out. And I'm not going to have...
Great.
Did I do better?
Great.
Thanks. So, the difference again in from a hardware perspective, that means that we have really two CPUs in the laptop, one that deals with the radio and one that deals with the everything else. And that's not uncommon. All devices these days which are very power conscious, a prime example being cell phones, usually have two and three CPUs. All smartphones have at least two, and sometimes three if they have Wi-Fi. And that's the reason, because then they can shut off big pieces of their electronics, large parts of their electronics, while keeping standard functionality running at a much lower power consumption. This is where it gets a little bit of technical. I'm not going to try to explain it too much, but the next piece that we need to have in order to have collaboration is we have to have applications that support collaboration. There are two ways to do that. You can do that on a per application basis, so every time that you add, you want to enable collaboration on an application, you go in there and you add the necessary support from top to bottom. Or you can develop a library, what we call a collaboration middleware, where that library provides all the necessary functionality. For example, it provides hooks into the present service. So if you want to find if there is another laptop running that kind of application out there, all you have to do is ask that subsystem, and you don't have to go and recode this thing all the time. So that's what we call our collaboration middleware. We are using, for the most part these days, a relatively general framework called telepathy that provides those services to applications. There are various components depending on what kind of underlying network transport you are using. And right now, this thing works, and you have seen it demonstrated out there with the various collaborative applications. What we would like to improve is the scalability. And by scalability, we mean how many nodes can you have on a given network, how many nodes you can have in a classroom, how many nodes you can have in an apartment building or a village, doing things concurrently. Right now, what we have, our framework is very generic. Doesn't take into consideration what happens at the lower layers. It's more tuned from for a more traditional transport like Ethernet or standard Wi-Fi. It doesn't accommodate a multi-home mesh network transport, which has its own challenges. So we have a little bit of a bidder's mismatch, if you want, in a more technical term, between our middleware, which is a lot more generic, and the mesh network, which has its own peculiarities. And we would like to address that. so that we can have more nodes being able to collaborate, especially in the scenario where there is no infrastructure. John Warlington will tell you about what we can do in a not completely infrastructureless environment with a school server, and why a school server is a good idea when you have to have many XORs, especially concentrated under the same roof. But the hard technical challenge, which still remains, and we have some pretty good ideas on how to address, is what are we going to go back to collaboration. We can define it as in a different number of ways, but it's basically the ability of students to work together, share data, communicate with each other. And you have to have a network connection to do that. The network connection that you have and what type of network connection you have determines a lot of the parameters of what you can currently do and what you can't. Mainly in the area of how many laptops you can have in a small area, or how many laptops you can have doing the same thing at any given time. This is something that I would like to emphasize again and again. I used a slide from John Warlington because it's very important to get that point across. That the mesh that we added on the XO laptop is not a replacement for Wi-Fi. It is there to enable communications beyond those that are possible by standard Wi-Fi. And it's not to be used in places where Wi-Fi works very well. And where Wi-Fi works very well is in an environment like this. I can count more than 40 laptops in here right now. There is no point, and most of them are connected to the internet, there is no point in an environment like this to use a multi-hop mesh network to communicate with the internet. There is an access point over there. Every laptop can get to that access point. If we try to use a multi-hop mesh network transport, it will work, sort of, but you will flood the spectrum very quickly because you have all these laptops in the same space that are emitting all that control traffic in order to form the links with each other and to establish the paths that they have to use in order to get to the internet, even if the internet is only one hop away. And in practical terms, it means that this will break things at the end. You will have a poorer experience in this environment with mesh than what the experience that you are going to have with Wi-Fi. And the takeaway there is don't use the mesh transport in classrooms. It's not made for classrooms. Access points can, good quality access points can be had for as low as $40 these days, so it's not a financial burden to get an access point in a classroom. So, when we try to... Yes?
What is your view of the mesh? So, when you leave our 7-year-old kid with a laptop, so does the laptop automatically detect that?
Right now, it tries to automatically detect everything. I think it tries to do too many things automatically for its own sake. This is an item of hot debate among the members of the tech team. I think that the way to move forward on that is to have a school button somewhere in the laptop. And when the kids go to school, they press the school button, and the laptop does the configuration for the school. And then when they're out of the school, they press the amount button, and the laptops try to find other laptops without infrastructure or things like that. Obviously, we don't expect 7-year-olds to become experts in wireless networking, although I have a hope that 11 years old olds will. There's no button. Right now, yes, there is a little bit of interaction that the kid can have, but the laptop has a mind of its own today. And if you have your environment set up according to what the laptop expects, everything works fine. If you deviate a little bit of what the laptop from what the laptop expects, the laptop gets cranky. So it tries to do its own thing, and it doesn't agree with its user all the time. It does something relatively reasonable, but it's not a seamless experience, as seamless as we would like it to be. Again, there is, besides the question of how the network in the school is configured, there are a lot of other questions to be answered in the background that have to do with what kinds of services are present in the school. And more importantly, if there is a collaboration server in the school. When you have high density deployment environments, it's instead of having every laptop broadcast its information to all the other laptops, this is what has to happen if you don't have any intermediary in between them. It's much better to add a server somewhere in the middle and tell everybody, go and use that server. We haven't found a way to make the peer-to-peer solution more scalable yet in an environment like this. So the current logic in the laptop tries to take into consideration all of these parameters. And again, sometimes it works very well, sometimes you get fine with your laptop a little bit, which is not a bad thing. You learn in the process.
Can I share my experimentation?
Sure.
Yeah, right, okay. Right. We set up the school server, and we took two exos. The max, you know, the exo for communication with the school server was 300 meters. We tried in all directions, and I'm telling you the weather conditions also. And then when we went out in the campus of this university, the two exos could very easily communicate to each other at 700 meters. And then I was not satisfied. I went to the mountains. Because then, you know, we could not increase the one. And we are still working on it. And one of my developers, he's pulling his hair out. He says, you know, they could do it in Australia with 2 kilometers. Yes. Why can't I do it here?
I can tell you we went back to the range between the laptops so that we don't confuse the people. But the reason is that at this environment of what you just described, the difference between 300 meters, 700 meters, and 1,000 meters, if you want to have the experience the same between laptops, you have to spend several $100 making the laptops, so that all the antennas are exactly the same, all the connectors are exactly the same, and you have exactly the same characteristics. The radios have small differences. Everything there has tolerances in the manufacturing. And unless you are talking about very, very expensive, you know, space-grade equipment, those tolerances are quite wide for consumer electronics. So I think your experience has to do with the fact that the performance varies well.
But keep in mind, you know, the weather conditions were not really normal. We had 14 degrees centigrade temperature, which comes to 57 degrees Fahrenheit, and it was partly cloudy, and the humidity was 48%.
Well, I don't know. I mean, humidity was probably what got you.
And you know, and it was windy, 44 kilometers per hour.
I don't think the wind had anything to do with it.
It surprises me. It doesn't have to do.
frames are not, wireless frames are not getting deviated too much by wind.
What can we try to find out an answer to why we were not successful? So these are all the...
Yeah, I'm glad that you're doing so detailed experiments, but I don't think you will be able to be conclusive in that matter.
No, we could not.
But the bottom line is that if you can get 300 meters in a university campus, that's one of the best results that I ever heard of. Really, 300 meters in a university campus is a great result. It's, I mean, also for radio, for example, one good way to increase the range between laptops. I don't know how practical it is from a usability point of view. Maybe we can ask Evan to tell us. You can get a long stick and put the laptop very high up. And I don't know what implications that on user interface, but it, I guarantee you that it will increase your range dramatically if you do that. I'll get to that at the end of my talk, because this is something that's very dear to me. I started playing with radios when I was 7 years old. So this is, I mean, this is the best story ever that ever happened, as far as I'm concerned. And I will tell you about some of the things that we are doing so that kids can play with radios in a way that it is very constructive and can teach them a lot of things about radio communication, communications in general. But the main takeover is that don't try to use the mesh just because we have it in there as a replacement for standard Wi-Fi. Standard Wi-Fi is a very proven technology. It gets better by the year, it gets cheaper by the year. And when we started doing this project 3 years ago, the situation was a lot worse than it is right now. Right now, you can get pretty good equipment at very low prices, so it shouldn't be a problem with the schools. There is still an issue with schools that has to have with the wiring expense. So it's not, equipment is almost free. I can't say the same thing for installation, especially in places in the developed world where the electrical code, for example, is very strict, and how you wire a classroom to get the access point connected to the internet gateway might be the main cost element there. Yes.
I understand that mesh is not replacing a figure replacement for Wi-Fi, but why should it be used in the classrooms? You said it shouldn't, so why exactly?
It shouldn't be used in large classrooms. And the reason that it shouldn't be used in large classrooms, I mean, if you have nothing else, by all means use it. But, and it will, you know, your results might vary depending on what you're trying to do and how many kids you have in the classroom. But if you want a relatively predictable environment, it's not going to work, because what will happen is that the current software on the laptop will quickly flood the radio spectrum. If you have 50 laptops in a classroom, and you want to communicate a piece of information on every laptop, what will have to happen is that every laptop will have to broadcast that piece of information once. If you have an access point, you send it once to the access point, and then everybody receives it. And you know that. In a mesh network, since you don't know from the beginning what is the pattern of communication, in order to make sure that everybody gets that communication, you have to retransmit that many times. Now, if the laptops are far away from each other, and that transmission happens in stages, that is not an issue. But if the laptops are all in the same room, and they all try to transmit concurrently, you run out of spectrum. You run out of radio very quickly. And there is really nothing that we can do. We can improve what we have, but this is not something that we can solve in the next few months or few years, if you ask me. It's quite a difficult problem. And again, let's not try to optimize something for which we have a very simple solution, which is add an access point. Now, we have the situations where people are asking us, you know, I have a school with 1,000 laptops. And I want all of these 1,000 laptops to be online and collaborating concurrently at any given time. That is, again, a very hard engineering problem that even very, very high-end equipment vendors will have a hard time meeting. From the practical experience that we have seen, is that the kids learn to work around it. So they figure out quickly that they can't do everything concurrently, so it happens in stages. You can add many access points in a school, doesn't cost a lot. Depends how many you have to add, depends on the architecture of the school, depends on the materials for the walls. Sometimes thick walls is a big object. Sometimes thick walls can help you because they isolate one classroom from the other, so one classroom doesn't interfere with the other. So there is no vanilla answer there. What I can say to you is that this is technology that has been mastered by a lot of people because it's mature technology. It has been around for over 10 years now. I installed the first access point network in this building 12 years ago, actually, and I think it was the first building in MIT that had full coverage. So lots of people can master that technology and can give you a very good solution that doesn't cost a lot of money. Companies, high-end equipment companies, might try to persuade you that you need the most expensive equipment possible. The rule by which to judge what people tell you is that the telco industry and the equipment industry has this rule where when you want to add nines to the availability of the system, every time you add a nine, the price doubles or goes up by an order of magnitude depending on what you do. So if you are okay with a system that's usable 90% of the time, you have to pay a small fraction of the money that you will have to pay for a system that's available 99% of the time. And if you really want a telco-grade system that's available all the time and can do the wireless under all circumstances, you have to ask yourselves, do I really want that? And if that's a requirement, then prepare to spend 10 times more money for that extra 0.9%. That's the way this thing works. These things work. And in the developed world, we have services. We are used to services that are many nines of availability. And that's the way the telco industry works, and that's why we are playing. If you go to your home and your internet connection doesn't work for an hour per day, you're going to be pretty pissed. They're going to go and tell people, take that out. If you go to a school in a poorer area and you tell them, look, you have nothing right now. I'm going to give you an internet connection that works 50% of the time. Everybody's going to be very, very excited. So you have to remember what's the expectation level there. And you have to make your cost analysis very, very carefully. It doesn't cost a lot of money at the end of the day if you take into consideration those parameters.
I was just curious about reliability difference if sharing with the neighborhood as opposed to sharing with an individual. I tried this experiment with a group of people using EXOs, and when they were sharing an activity with the neighborhood, not so reliable as you were saying, but if they tried to share with somebody specifically, the reliability increased greatly. Is that true? Is there a technical reason?
There is. I'm not sure the exact conditions of your experiment, but what you are describing is generally true in the sense that the more people that you have participating in an activity right now, the less reliable the communication is going to be, especially in the peer-to-peer case, because the probability that every node will get the transmission from every other node goes down as the number of nodes increases. And that's, I don't know if I can explain that less in a more less technical way, but that's the way it works. And when you have a server in the middle, for example, that equation changes quite dramatically. If you have an access point in the middle, that equation changes because the probability of delivery goes up. So in general, you have to remember that wired networks these days have very, very low bit rates, bit error rates. So you can assume that with, even if you don't do much of error correction in a local area network, if you send something, you can pretty much assume that it's going to be delivered. In a Wi-Fi network, that's not really the case. In standard Wi-Fi networks, error rates of up to 20% for multicast and broadcast rate is nothing, it's something that's routinely observed. And in a mesh network transport, that's even worse, depending on the environment. So, yes, what you observe is correct. Yes?
One thing I was going to try to get the cost out of it, I don't know if you're familiar, I'm sure you are, with OpenWRT,
yes,
the open source terminal that we're using. And found that it quite dramatically improved the performance.
We are testing. We are testing a lot of access points, and to your to support what you just said, a standard Linksys WRT54 with the Linksys firmware can support something like 30 access points, 30 clients reliably. If you add OpenWRT over there, that goes up to 50. So what you are saying is,
we grabbed ASUS W500G, which has a name on it. I haven't tested it on quantity, but I can put it in one office and probably also people can do it anyway, where they would have done about just the speed.
That's the stuff that I would really like to get local capacity built on. That's the stuff that local people, local support people should be using, because there is a trick there in what you said is, with the right open source software, the right software on these access points, you can take completely consumer stuff that are made for 90% availability, and you can make them 99% stuff without having to pay the price. And that's something that we really encourage people to do. You will hear from Uruguay in what they are doing, and for certain schools, they are building access points themselves, because they found out that the easiest way to build a high-capacity access point is to take a MicroTik board and add MicroTik software, which is largely based on open-source components with a proprietary management system, and that's how they get their high-capacity access point built from scratch without having to pay $2,000 for it. So that's something that we would really like to encourage local people to pick up on. On the other end, when people are coming to us and they are saying, what can we do at schools, and we don't really know how to set up these things, we have to give them a solution that's easily implementable from whatever components they have there without them having fuss around with things like, you know, uploading a proprietary firmware, a different firmware on some of this equipment, voiding warranties and things like that. Collaboration, I went through this slide during the Q&A session, so I'm not gonna say anything more. I'm going to share with you what we are going to do in the future for this ad hoc scenario where there is no infrastructure. With the current middleware that we have in place, we are able to, on a peer-to-peer fashion, we are able to reliably have a chat session between 10 nodes. That works reliably, it's a repeatable result. I can repeat it pretty much any day. Here at the Media Lab, one PhD student, developed a different way of doing the collaboration communication between multiple nodes. He calls his work Cerebro. And he has already made tests under the same environment where he can have 65 nodes doing the same thing. And this is something that you will see coming up soon. So we are not in any way satisfied with what we have right now. We just wanted to give people something that will be a starting point, and you will see constant improvements coming out from now on. Yes? This is completely software. This is all software. This is, and it's actually software that right now is working on plugging in the existing middleware so that we don't have to change many things and as many applications as possible can take advantage of it. But we feel very confident that we can improve a lot the peer-to-peer scenario. And then we have the many, many node scenario where servers have to be involved at some point. And that's what John is going to be talking to you later in the day. Yes?
We put a Gen 2 device. Will there be any support for G3 or YMAX?
It's too early to tell. What I can say, that was a very good question. Let's say 3G, you mean?
Yeah.
We have gotten a lot of requests from potential deployments to support 3G and cellular modems on the laptops themselves right now. And we are going to do that via the USB port. The basic software support is already in Linux. We don't really need to invent anything besides a nice management interface, an easy-to-use management interface. But we had already at least 3 requests from various people that we need to get some support for 3G on this current laptop. My guess is that by then we will be able to get a relatively cost-effective combo chip that will do Wi-Fi, WiMAX, and 3G. The first ones already are available today. Qualcomm has a chipset announced already, and Intel just certified one with the FCC. So I'm fairly confident that with the 2010, by the 2010 time frame, we won't have to be limited to just Wi-Fi. Other question? Forward.
One on Cerebral. So when this will be available, I'm assuming you'll have to upgrade for an existing laptop before you'll have to all upgrade then from the
school. Yes. Yes. Realistically speaking, if you get laptops today or if you get laptops in the next couple of months, you will have to upgrade anyway for a variety of other reasons. Power management is just coming together in a meaningful way. We can do much, much better in battery life than the 4 hours that we are doing right now. So you will expect that there will be a constant stream of upgrades going on in the future. So at some point in time, you will get that, whether you want it or not, because you will have to update for another reason, for sure. I want to go now to the fun part of the presentation. And I will go into my general connectivity talk, the one that I used to give in the beginning of this project, and the one that I'm deeply interested in. And that's the do-it-yourself part. Here at the Media Lab, we're firm believers that, and we're still actually, but we started saying that quite some time ago, that these days we see a phenomenon in telecommunications that's very reminiscent of what we saw in the early 80s in the personal computing industry. And what happened in the early 80s was that computing came out of the glass walls, came out of being a centrally controlled activity, and became an end-user activity with the element of the IBM PC, personal computers, the Apple II. That was made possible mostly by Moore's Law. These devices became affordable enough for that to happen. So suddenly everybody had control over their computing, which is very important. Before that, you didn't have any control whatsoever. All the applications that you could use were delivered to you by a central computer. Your terminal couldn't change anything. This is sort of how telecommunications worked up now. The services that you could run were all determined by your telco, and you shouldn't dare change them. We see that changing rapidly. What current cell phones can do are not by any means strictly controlled by the providers anymore. We see that the tide is changing. We see that in places all over the world, community networks spring up by using low-cost, inexpensive, license-free telecommunications equipment, mostly Wi-Fi based. Again, the amount of computational power that exists on a Wi-Fi radio is very comparable to what you could get on a personal computer a few years ago. The amount of processing that goes into a Z, 82.11Z, or now with the 82.11M, the newer radios. And that costs a few dollars. And it's available to everybody. And you can use it without having to get a license from anybody. So if you put all these components together, you get a lot of telecommunications infrastructure starting from the bottom up. Up to now, telecommunications was a complete top-down approach. You had to buy spectrum, spend billions and billions of dollars in equipment costs, and deploy a network for many, many users concurrently. What you can do now is start small and start building slowly. So what we would like to see is ways that this bottoms-up and that top-down can get together at some point. I would like to encourage in OLPC deployments, things like that. So, obviously, if you're in the middle of Africa, you have to have some big guy help you get out. What you don't have to do is use that guy in every site that you have to get out. So if you get one satellite link, there are many things that you can do in order to spread the reach of that satellite link out in the community. The laptop mesh network philosophy is exactly that as far as internet access. This is a very, very starting step, very, very bottom. It hasn't lifted up too much yet, but it's a small building block. We like to encourage people to explore that capability. And in that respect, we have facilitated the deployment of very low cost connectivity technology that end users can deploy and grow networks in an organic fashion. In the same way that, you know, cities that, like Vienna in Austria, have a totally community-run wireless network that has 400 routers up on roofs, which is not controlled by anybody, it's not paid by anybody, all that you pay is the access fees to the external world. And when these networks grow, their value goes up, and the amount of traffic that has to traverse the external links become smaller and smaller. Our first attempt in that area was with a company called Meraki Networks. We are among the first backers of Meraki Networks. It's a startup out in California, in Silicon Valley, from students, MIT students, who created very, very inexpensive Wi-Fi mesh routers, infrastructure mesh routers. So if you want to unwire a village and to provide internet connection to a small geographical area, you buy these things at a price that ranges from $50 to $100. They give you a very nice management interface. You just hang them in places that they can see each other, and you have instantaneous infrastructure. It's not going to be very fast. It's not going to be, you know, 99.99%, but it's a lot better than nothing, and it doesn't cost a lot of money. You still have to do pretty involved technical stuff there. So I would like to take that model and see how we can take it down to the laptop. And our answer to that was something that we call the active antenna, which actually, fortunately, I didn't bring any with them. We have them ready now for testing by various people to start deploying them in the field, which is essentially the radio that we have on the laptop packaged in a waterproof plastic case with external antennas and a long USB cable. Most people will think, okay, what's the difference with that? I mean, that's another radio like the one you already have on the laptop. You can do many, many things with it. You don't have, for example, if you want to access an access point that's outside your house, in most cases, you have to go with a laptop and sit on the window that's facing towards the direction of that access point. It doesn't make for a very efficient user scenario. With this module, which these days we can make for about $20, I would say, you can decouple your physical location by about 5 meters. Very easily. If you are using the mesh network in an environment like Araquai or a small village like that, since this thing has the same radio like in the laptop, what we can do is just power up that device. You don't even have to connect it to a laptop. And it becomes a repeater. So instead of having a laptop that's turned off and has only its radio on, this is just a radio, you can just power it on, and, for example, will help you collaborate with a kid across the street without you having to be by the window all the time. And you can do other things like making it an access point on a server, or making the server part of the mesh network by attaching it to a server. The antenna is built in a way that has external connectors. If people want to experiment with high range point-to-point links, they can do that. If the kids want to link their laptops over a higher distance, they can point these things, they can optimize the placement of these things, and they can create links that are several hundred meters, or if you have external antennas, kilometers. One of the reasons that we wanted to package the active antenna like that is that so that kids don't get into the temptation of actually opening the laptop and attaching high range antennas to the existing laptop, because the connectors there are very easy to break. And this is, as far as I'm concerned, at this point in time, the lowest cost Lego block for connectivity that you can buy all over the world. There is no other standalone mesh router that you can buy for $20. And it works with our laptop right now. We have teams, 2,000 of those, and we are going to deploy them in We're going to spread them across the our existing deployments around the world and get some real usage scenarios from the kids themselves. The first we got, the first and the most strong request came from Uruguay, because Uruguay is starting the deployment inside the cities next year, and they are interested in the in this scenario, so that the kids can access an external access point without having to be on the window all the time. So it's a good start, but we are also interested in the standalone. I'm mostly interested in this standalone scenario up there, where an active antenna in the middle that's only plugged to power enables communication between two laptops that would not be able to communicate otherwise. Again, the Meraki guys at some point were selling their routers, their mesh routers, for $50. We beat them to the punch at 20, and I'm fairly confident that I can make those for 15 in mass quantities. We just built 2,000 units right now, and for 2,000 units using various vendors, the price came down to $15. I'm sure I can do a lot better with those. So that's my... I would love to have these things back when I was 10. I guess my son will have to play with those now. Not bad. And I would like to finish with some videos. One video that some kids down in Washington, D.C. did in order to explain the mesh network operation to other kids. And I would like to thank the Northern Learning Team for facilitating that collaboration. To steal the thunder of Chuck as the director, creator of movies. So the rest of them you can find at the Northern Learning website. They are pretty nice, actually. I would really encourage you to go and check them out. Any more questions? Yes?
Those basic rules about access points and number of things, are the guidelines you're producing that will be available for people to draw on and interpret?
Can you repeat the question? I didn't get that.
The guidelines about
the guidelines,
number of laptops per access point and collaboration and things like that, are there going to be some guidelines to make available?
Yes, yes. There will be some very dynamic guidelines, because the guidelines change with every version of our system software, but yes, there will be guidelines. What we also will be doing is we will be helping large deployments, at least with initial setups, as we have done with all of our existing deployments out there. We'll be testing equipment for people because we would like people to buy equipment that's available to them at the optimal price and not what we are suggesting here from Boston for purchase in Latin America, for example, or you know, in Turkey or in Mongolia. And we will be updating those guidelines constantly. Yes?
With the child taking the laptop home, would you be able to communicate with other, or is it only assured that you will?
Of course. That's when you take a laptop home, and you have other laptops around you, maybe in the next house, for example, in the next apartment, the kids in the next apartment have a laptop, by all means, that's the main scenario for which we developed the mesh technology to enable. That's exactly the scenario that we try to enable. And we emphasized, as you saw, mostly the collaboration between the kids. The internet connectivity is part of a weekend. It's part of a larger picture. More people have to be involved. But even without that, kids have to be able to communicate between them at all possible times. And the laptops are fully compatible, again, with existing infrastructure, hotspots, access points, whatever you might have available. I think it's 3.
Yeah, so we have a break next. We can
take a break. And then it's Fiorella from Uruguay.
Yeah, we'll hear from her 5 minutes.